Blog Talk Radio.
923, I'll give you a corrected address, but you have a fire in a one story ordinary. Looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control. Squad 5, squad 5. England to 273, 273. England Battalion, 1818 Battalion. With a 273, 273.
I'm actually broadcasting from my mom's apartment in Chelsea, New York, on 24th Street and 8th Avenue. And this is where I was born, actually. So I was listening to the intro, and it struck me that if you listen to it, you probably think that we're getting ready to listen to, like, PBS and the some kind of literature show or some kind of really high-class opera whatever type thing, you know. Anyway, I still play that because it's a joke. I think I started playing it because I think my daughter, it was her symphony that played it. But anyway, well, I'm on my own tonight. I don't have any guests. So if you'd like to call in, the number is 760-454-8852. That's 760-454-8852. And tonight, we're going to talk about top floor fires. But first, before we get started with the top floor fires, I got an email today from one of the chiefs on my job that works at the fire academy. He's in charge of training for the FDNY. And it looks like I'm going to be working with two other battalion chiefs on a project for the fire department on advancing training and becoming a, sort of a liaison between the field and the fire academy, and looking for new ways to push forward training, which I'm a big advocate of. I think it's extremely important to train like we play. That's how we become good at it, because we know that if we rely just on our experience, real life experience, that we might fall a little short. So we have to just constantly go at it and be diligent in the training. I just came back recently from Guayaquil, Ecuador. We did a nice week of training. They wanted some RIT training, and we came up with some nice scenarios for them. We actually did, the same class in Lima. I'm not sure if I had spoken on the radio prior or after that trip to Lima, so actually within the last, I guess 2 months or so, I'm not sure, we did basically the same training. And what we did was we came up with a scenario where at first we, you know, we had the firefighters get used to going in and doing a search, an aggressive search, you know, using a search rope and without the protection of a hand line. And then, you know, at some point we would, backtrack. We actually reviewed all the maydays and the urgents, what constitutes a mayday, what constitutes an urgent, and, you know, try to clear that up, because I think, you know, especially down in Lima and Guayaquil, that's probably a new concept for them. You know, we've been at that for a while in the New York City Fire Department, but, you know, in Latin America, I don't think that was something that, you know, is kind of second nature to them. So we created that scenario, and it worked out pretty well. We set them up with a RIT, you know, like a RIT kit, you know, like different tools of Stokes and some ropes and some hand tools, and most importantly, what we call a fast pack or a rip pack, you know, an extra air bottle or, you know, an air pack to address their needs, you know, adjust the fire, the air, any injuries, and then the rescue. So that was cool. And then we did it down in Guayaquil. We used their brand new academy. And we kind of stepped it up a little bit because we had a better facility. So what we did, we actually worked the urgents in with the Maydays. And it actually evolved into a very, very cool exercise. What we did was we used four teams. We had the first team was the attack team. The second team was the rescue, search and rescue team. The third team was the backup team for the backup line, for a second hose line if needed. And the fourth team was the RIT. And what I did was I had the search and rescue go in and locate the fire. When they located the fire, the idea was that they were going to call for a hose line. So they would call for the hose line. And then when they brought the hose line in, I'd give them a few minutes, you know, maybe 5 minutes or so, whatever, less than 5 minutes. And what I did was there was a Y. We had two lines off the – one line off the pumper, one supply, 2.5 or 3, I think it was 3.5 actually, with a Y on it. And we stretched 2.5 inches, so 1.75 inches. I can't remember now if they had 1.5 or 1.75 inches. And what I would do – is I would give the signal to cut the line. And what I was looking for was for the engine, the attack team, to give an urgent that we had lost water, because I had taught them that if you lose water, it's critical to notify everybody. And, you know, why is that? You know, it's critical because if guys are operating above and you lose water, then, you know, the guys have to know about it on the floor above, or else, you know, they could wind up in a bad way. So that was like the first part of the exercise. So what they would do is they would give the urgent, and then I would have them back the line out, and then we would have the search team get out. And then, so what we did is we pulled one guy off the search team, the search and rescue team, and held him back. And now the second engine would go in, the second attack team would go in with the hose line. And at some point, I was looking for them to say, when they came out, to do an accountability. And the idea was that they were supposed to give a mayday for a missing member. And sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. You know, if they didn't, I'd prompt them. And then now with the missing member, it was now critical to activate the RIT team. And the RIT team would work in concert with the engine and go in and try to locate the downed firefighter. So, you know, that was the basic premise. We worked a few variations on it. But it turned out to be a nice drill. So, you know, if you're looking for a nice multi-unit drill, that's something to think about. You know, get four teams together. Because I'm a definite big proponent of you know, stretching that backup line. If there's a hose line operating, there should be a second hose line ready to go. I've always done that. I can remember we had a fire back in about 20 years ago. I guess I was still a lieutenant. And the first two engine went in. It was a vacant building. They had a lot of fire. I think it was like 2 or 3 floors of fire. And, you know, first engine went in. And I don't know what happened. Somehow they either had a burst length or something got jammed in the intake. And before you know it, they lost water. But what was nice about it was that the officer, who's, you know, he's a friend of mine, and we worked together. We ran in a lot together. He just very calmly gave an urgent, you know, urgent, urgent, urgent. We lost water. He backed out the line, and I told my guys, I said, let's go. And it's like as they were moving out, we were moving in. So it was a very seamless transition. And I've been in instances before where we lost water. And, you know, that's why we have that second hose line. You know, that's why it's there. Because I was actually kind of proud of the guys in Chile because I had gone over that with those guys in a class. I was down there in I don't know what month it is. I think it was January, let's say. And I taught them again the importance of doing a second hose line, and they had a problem with water. And as soon as the standpipe busted, they were ready to go with that second line. And I think I spoke about this actually last time on the last show. So anyway, so that was the drill. That's the May Day RIT urgent drill, and it's something to really review because I've been involved in a few May Days, and I remember the first one. The first May Day I was ever at, I was only on the job. Gosh, I was only on the job a few months. It was probably in December of '86, maybe. We had a fire in a five-story tenement. Fire on two floors. It was occupied, and the roof firefighter from the second due truck company. He somehow, I don't know what he did, but he was trying to cross over onto the roof of the fire building, and he wound up missing a step, and he fell off the roof, and he wound up in the shaft. And he gave a May Day. And it was like, I'm not going to say it was chaotic, but it was not the way it is today. There was no, at that time, there was no FAST or RIT team in place. You know, basically, I think what happened was I remember being on the floor above, and it was like a heavy amount of fire. And I remember there was a hole. The fire had burned through the floor from the third to the fourth floor. And I thought, for some reason, that the May Day happened, like, I thought someone went down that hole. You know, and so anyway, guys kind of just dropped everything. And he was, like, in this enclosed shaft, so there was no, like, windows or anything. And what saved him, really, was the fact that there was probably about one story's worth of rubbish in there. So he just, and he wore an air pack, and I have to be honest, back then, the roof firefighters generally didn't wear an air pack. They were generally older guys that had come on a job in the 60s, and, you know, it wasn't something that they would do. But he had an air pack on. And between the air pack slowing down his fall because he was, like, kind of wedged in his shaft, and the rubbish, whatever was in there, the mattresses and whatnot, had cushioned his fall. So he wound up surviving, but he got banged up pretty good because he went down probably five flights. And, you know, obviously that he never came back to full duty after that and retired. But that was the first May Day. And the second one was probably very shortly after that. Same companies. A firefighter was on the roof. It was a vacant building. It was a one-story commercial. We had a heavy fire in this kind of abandoned... I guess it's a factory or a kind of a one-story commercial garage or whatever it was. And he was up on the roof, and I was working with another guy, and we were kind of knocking out the cinder blocks. And we kind of made an opening, and we, you know, called for a hose line. We didn't have a radio back then. Guys, we didn't have a lot of radios, but, you know, we called for a hose line, and next thing you know, I saw something drop. That's all I could say. That's the only way I could describe it. Dropped, and he had fallen, and he landed, which was amazing. There was a lot of machinery in this place, and he landed on the only, I guess, homeless people living there. He landed on a bed, And we were able to get in there pretty quickly, and we just kind of escorted him out. So we never, I think the chief or somebody saw the, what happened when he went through the roof, it vented the roof, and it looked a lot worse than it really was, because he had passed through the fire, and he kind of got below it a little bit, so we kind of, I guess, kind of just grabbed his arms and dragged him out. So it happened so fast. So a mayday was given, but it was never, it wasn't a prolonged one. And then there was a few after that. There was a few collapses and whatnot. So, but we didn't have this RIT team. And now that we have these RIT teams, you know, it's a job that, like Gordon Graham says, he says that, you know, low frequency but high risk, you know. And, you know, it could be, I guess, discouraging to be assigned the RIT and go to fire after fire, and you know, I guess most of the time nothing really happens. But it you know, it's that one time that it does happen, you know, and that we have to be prepared for. So, you know, this is why I encourage these guys to train on this frequently. And the guys in my house are great. 94 and 48. I was working my last set of tools before I went on vacation. One of my lieutenants, Bobby Musa, does this fantastic drill with the Stokes. And, you know, doing a 2-to-1, bringing a down firefighter up like a narrow stairway, you know, and doing some diamond lashing. So, you know, if you're ever at the firehouse and, you know, you can't think of something to drill on, you know, that's... it's always a great drill, and if you need any ideas, I have some great pictures of that latest drill. I'd be happy to share them with you and give you some information on those drills. And you can always reach me on Facebook or Twitter or email. My email is my name, DanielPSheridan@gmail.com, and I'd be very happy to share any of those drills with you. So, anyway. But tonight we're going to talk about top floor fires. And it's been a very interesting winter here in New York City. We've had just an incredible, like, run of top floor fires in the last few months. Actually, they had one yesterday up in the North Bronx. And, you know, top floor fires, they're unusual. I mean, they really take a large commitment of forces, you know. And, you know, the idea is to really get ahead of them. So, anyway, so let's, we'll talk about top floor fires. First, I'll give the number again if someone wants to join in and ask anything else, it's fine. 760-454-8852. So I wrote an article, it hasn't been published yet. About getting ahead of top floor fires. I was asked to do one, and as part of speaking, I guess, they would like you to do an article, so I'm not sure where it's going to show up, but my last set of tours, before I went on vacation, it was a snowy, you know, one of those nor'easter-type storms. And it was interesting because it was Saturday night, and I was scheduled to get on a plane at midnight. And actually, luckily, my plane was delayed. But you know, I was heading down to Ecuador, and about 20 to 6, we got a call for a fire. And it was a little bit out of my area. The other chief was involved in another administrative thing, and the chief that was relieving me was working in another firehouse, so, you know, I was still on duty. So I got in the car, and you know how you could just tell when it's, you know, it's the real thing. So I started in my mind just doing like a size up, you know, and I always use that coal was welt, you know, and I was getting reports now for a top floor fire, and I always tune in, especially when the dispatches say, like, instead of saying smoke or, you know, anything else, anything that you could think of. I mean, they use that word fire, and they say fire on a specific place, you know, top floor, whatever, I tend to kind of zone in on that. And something told me that it wasn't going to be a food on the stove. I just had a little sixth sense that, you know, that this might be something that I should pay attention to. So, you know, I was very dialed into the radio and listening to what the dispatcher had to say. And he was getting more information, and it was snowing like a blizzard, man. It was coming down like crazy now. And so I did that little size up in my head, you know, and I thought, all right, so coal was well. So what do we do? It's a six-story H-type, and it's a building that I know. I know that it's like at like three or four wings. It's like one of the biggest buildings in our area, if not the biggest. So, you know, I knew the address. So in my mind, I did a quick size up. You know, I said construction. I know it's type 3, class 3. So, you know, we're going to have brick and, you know, wood. So we're going to have a combustible interior. You know, occupancy obviously is a multiple dwelling. Apparatus and, you know, equipment. I had 3 engines and 2 trucks on the box and myself. The location of the fire was going to be, sounded like it was going to be a top floor. The W was the weather, and it was an extreme snowstorm with extreme wind. The area on the was, the A, is going to be a very, very big cock loft. Street conditions, the S, is going to be horrible. The traffic was like 6 o'clock at night, so there was just a tremendous amount of traffic. The other W in the wealth is the water supply, and I knew that it was a potential that we were going to have frozen hydrants. The E, the exposures, is going to be probably none because it's such a big building. We have the other A, which I said, ready, auxiliary appliances, which didn't apply. I knew we didn't have any kind of standpipes or anything like that. The other L would be the life hazard. And, you know, you can never really downplay the life hazard. Even though it's 6 o'clock at night, it's a weekend, you're going to have a lot of people, you know. There's going to be a lot of people. We had that fire a few months ago. It was the same time, 6:30. And we had 13 fatalities at 6 o'clock at night, you know, not 6 in the morning. So the time, I said, was around the change of tours, around 6 o'clock. And the height was 6 stories. So, you know, you're going to get all ladders in there. So that was the size up that I did within a minute in my head. As I got closer to the box, I heard I can pick up the fire ground on my car radio because it's 45 watts and was it 40 watts? I'm sorry, it's 40 watts. So even though my own handy talkie doesn't really pick up the communication, I do get it on my car. I have my 800 megahertz, I have my 40 watt, and I have my radio dispatch. So I have like 3 radios next to me. And as I was getting closer, I could hear the guys, you know, calling, saying, you know, the outside vent gave a report. He did a 360, and he checked out the sign. He says, we got a fire on the top floor. I could see heavy smoke out the windows, you know. So the first thing I thought of is just based on his size up, from the car, not even being there, I contacted the dispatcher and I told him, I said, listen, I'm not on the scene yet, but give a 1075, which is a working fire, transmit the old hands and give us an extra engine and truck. And I did that because I just didn't want to take any chances. I mean, you know, it was snowing like crazy, so how long is it going to take companies to get there? You know, all these things were working against us, you know. And when I got on scene, it wasn't the building that I thought it was going to be. It was actually across the street. But nevertheless, it was still a big H-type. But it wasn't the one that I was thinking of where it was like these 3 or 4 wings, you know. So I had already done my size up. You know, I'm trying to get into my strategy. I hit the ground running. I saw the first engine already. I got a good water source. Truck took the front of the building. Truck got up there pretty quick, and the first two engines did a great job. 45 engine, 90 engine. They got that line up there in it seemed like just like in no time at all, like in 2 minutes it was up there. And they had already water in the line. And then I grabbed my third due engine, my fourth due engine, and I told them to start a second line just to back up that first line. As the companies were coming in, I started putting them into to various places. So I put the squad came in. I put the whole company on a roof, and I created a roof sector right off the bat. I had the rescue came in. I had them working on the top floor with the extra truck. And the captain in the first two trucks, 58 truck, he made a nice move. He asked the second two truck to go down to the floor below because the fire was in the walls and in the cockloft a little bit to see that it didn't start on the floor below. And I have to tell you, they knocked it out like in no time. It didn't turn into a cluster. I thought it was going to be, based on the way that the winter's been going, I thought for sure that, you know, that there was the potential there for, you know, a problem. So they did a great job. They had the, you know, the line up there so quickly. And I think that's the key, man. That's the key for, you know, a top floor fire because, you know, in one aspect, you think that a top floor fire is like the easiest fires in a way because, you know, there's less risk because there's no, you know, there's no one above it. So, you know, you don't have people trapped on the floors above. In that respect, yes, it is, you know, in that sense, but no, because, you know, the biggest factor that we're dealing with in a top floor fire is that common cockloft. It's that area between this top floor ceiling and the roof, that space. It could be anywhere from a foot to, in some rope frame buildings, it's big enough for a person to stand up in. So, and it's like a mini lumber yard. I mean, it's just nothing but dried out wood. So, you know, it's critical that, you know, we get a handle on what's happening, you know. So, so the first thing, let's go over the steps, you know. So the first step would be to locate the fire. And one of the fires we had a few months ago, it turned into a multiple alarm. It was just a tremendous amount of fire in the cockloft. And I had heard, I was talking after the fire, after everything has been said and done, I heard some of the occupants talking, and he was like, yeah, I smelled something. And I heard some crackling up in the attic, he called it. That's verbatim, he said, in the attic, you know, earlier in the night, but I didn't think nothing about it. And I just can't get my head around this because in one sense, in New York City, people call us for anything. I mean, it's the amount of running and the things that they're calling for us now, it's mind-boggling, the things they call us for. And this has, like, been the second fire that I've been to, like, in the last month or two, where I heard the occupant say, yeah, well, I smelled something, or I heard something, but, you know, I didn't think nothing of it. I think this guy actually said that he notified the super, and then the super came up and said it was nothing. So, you know, we can't do it ourselves. We have to get the information, you know, from the clients, as Brunicini says, you know, they have to notify us, and if they don't notify us, then, you know, our hands are tied. So I think what had happened in this fire is that it was already advanced by the time our guys showed up there. And you're already behind the eight ball. So, you know, saving life is really the second priority. And I think if you ask most guys and you ask, well, what's the number one priority at a fire? You know, what's our main purpose? And I'm sure most people would say that our main job is save life. But it is, but we actually have to locate the fire first. because we can't do anything until we locate it. So, in that instance, you know, it's difficult sometimes because now, you know, locating it, unless we start popping holes in the ceilings and checking the roof, you know, the roofs are very well insulated. Like in this particular building, they had in this this one where the people didn't call, they had actually two ceilings, like a double ceiling. So they had a drop ceiling, the old ceiling, then they had a layer of foam, which was probably about an inch and a half thick. Then they had not only that, in between that, they had this spray-in foam insulation. And then the roof itself had a thick layer of plywood and then the asphalt. So, you know, those cocklofts now are really buttoned up pretty tight. And I think what's happening, why we're seeing a rash of all these advanced top floor fires, is that, you know, they also run the BX up there in the attic spaces, the concealed spaces, the cocklofts or whatever. And I think if they're using BX, you know, metal, it gets hot, and especially when it's laying on a joist. And what happens, you know, when something hot is laying on wood, it just breaks down. Pyrolysis occurs, and, you know, it takes, I don't know how long it would take, but with no ventilation, you know, you have this pyrolysis happening, and then it just keeps lowering the ignition temperature of the wood, and then eventually to one night where, boom, you get a spark, and it just gets what it needs, and then it just starts slowly cooking. And I think that's why these people are saying that they think they're smelling something, because it's nothing that's really overt. It's not like it's kind of like in your face and it's invisible. It's like this, I think it's just like this slow burn. And I think this is what's happening now in a lot of these buildings that have been renovated, because I've seen it myself, you know, not only in top floor fires, but in other fires, you know, where the BX is in the walls and it's just laying on the joists, and you know, it's just it's like this kind of you know, like this haze. Like, you know, a little trick that I do is if you turn off the lights and you take your beam from your flashlight and you hold it into the room, you could see the smoke particles in the beam of the flashlight. So, you know, that happened, I don't know when it happened, it was like a year ago. We had the same thing happen. We got a call for an odor of smoke, but it was very, very faint. And I think the officers that were working were ready to give me a signal, which we just call it an odor dissipated, okay? So I just, for some reason, I don't know what possessed me, but I decided to walk into the first floor, and I got something caught my attention. It was the occupant of one of the apartments on the first floor had said to me, "Hey, Chief, you know, the lights went out earlier. They were flickering." So then, I was like, you know, let me see what's going on here. And I went into the apartment, and I checked out, you know, the light that was flickering. I put my hand, the back of my hand on the wall, and sure, it was red hot. So, you know, I called the truck company down. I said, "Do me a favor, just open this up." And sure enough, that whole thing was burning. So, you know, I think this is what's happening in the cocklofts. I think that these BX cables are laying on the joists and just smoldering. And as a side note, too, we see that in the winter, too, with the radiator pipes. Sometimes the radiator pipes, when they're too close to the wood joists as well, you know, we have apartment houses in New York that are 100 years old, and they had steam heat probably since day one, and the same thing happens. This pyrolysis happens, and at some point, it just hits that ignition temperature, boom, so it goes. So anyway, so that's, I think, what's causing it. You know, other things that are happening, I think that anytime we get a call that involves the top floor, you have to do your due diligence. I am very, very cautious, and I'm very, very unlikely to ever take the recommendation if I get a one of my officers telling me, "Chief, you know what, we had an odor up here, but it's dissipated. So, you know, let's go with the signal that it's an odor of smoke, and, you know, let's be done with it." I never really take that as an answer. I want more of an investigation. And what I mean, too, is I don't mean, and I'm wondering if this is happening. I would love someone to tell me about this, because when I was a fireman, we didn't have thermal imaging cameras, and they didn't come on the scene until I think I was lieutenant. I remember I was working in Rescue 1, and that's the first time I saw a thermal imaging camera, and it probably weighed about 25 pounds. It was as big as like a little VCR, like a little TV. And I have to be honest with you, I don't have a lot of experience with thermal imaging cameras. You know, when the chief told us to check for extension or to open, you know, we opened up. We put our hand on the wall. You know, so I don't know that if guys now are taking the camera and aiming at the ceiling or behind the wall of the stove or whatever, and taking that as if they don't see anything, that there's no fire. Because me, I think there's nothing like just putting your hand on the wall, and if it's hot, you're going to have to do something about it. You're going to have to open something up, because that's the only way we're going to get a look inside. So that's like the biggest, I think, part of the top floor fire, is identifying it, locating it, and jumping ahead to like overhaul, which is like another way of just checking for extension. You know, just find out what the parameters are, you know. And so any food on a stove, especially a food on a stove where, you know, like it was greasy and there's a vent hood or something, and there was actually flame, you know, where it was impinging on the cabinets or whatever, and there's some charring. By all means, you have to get it above, or open up the ceiling above, or punch a hole or something. But you have to see what's going on behind there, because we just had another top floor fire recently, and it was funny because I was sitting in my office and I heard the box come in, and I knew the box from my experiences being, you know, a fireman in that area. So it was like, I know the buildings, they're rehab buildings. They've been renovated, and all kinds of other stuff going on with those buildings. So I paid attention to this box, because I knew that I was mistaken, though. I thought I was going to be the all-hands chief or the ops chief if it went to a working fire. So it was kind of weird, because it was around dinner time, and I heard the box come in, and I heard them give the signal for food on the stove. You know, we call it an 18. Just a one-in-one, engine in a truck, you know, no extension, no nothing. And I just don't know what possessed me, but I just said, like, it just didn't sound right. And then I heard something. I don't know if I heard it on the handy talkie, but I heard something along the lines of, "Hey, we got smoke now on the top floor," or something like that, "and I think we need a line." And I was like, "Oh, damn!" You know, so I ran down, and now I rushed through dinner, and I hear them, and they give the signal for working fire, and we didn't go, and I was surprised. It's like a block away from my response area. So, but I knew the building, and I said, "This is going to be something that you know, is gonna go quickly." And then sure enough, it wound up going to a second alarm, and then like a third alarm, and you know, this is what happens. You know, they said it was an electrical fire. It had started. The marshals came, and they did an assessment. And I think it was just a coincidence that there was a food on the stove. I don't think the food on the stove had anything to do with the fire. I think it was just one of those things where they were cooking and they burnt the pot, and then at the same time they had this thing going on in the cockloft. So it was just a big coincidence, you know. But nevertheless, you know, we're on the scene, and you're the battalion chief. I strongly encourage you to really do due diligence before you take up. Just make sure that you really feel confident that there's no extension, because, you know, it's happened more than once where, you know, food on a stove, or even you get called for an electrical emergency. You see a circuit breaker, and you see, around the outlet there's charring. You know, these things have to be investigated. You have to take the outlet apart and check the wood and make sure there's, you know, no extension. So, I don't know what the answer is to resolve this thing that's going on with us now with these top floor fires. But anyway, you know, once though we do have them, one thing that I'm an advocate for, and I think, I may have a hand in being able to do something about this, given my new capacity working in the training. But again, if you'd like to call in, please do, because I'm really talking to myself here. But 760-454-8852, and I would love to hear from you. But we have a new tool that's been around now for a year or two. I'm not sure now. I guess maybe it seems like it only not too long, but for a year or two now. And it's called the cockloft nozzle. And chiefs now are really starting to get the hang of it, and the companies are really starting to get the hang of it. And I'm really curious to find out if they used it yesterday up in the Bronx, because I have a feeling that they probably did, because we've had now quite a few chances to use it, and guys are getting much more comfortable with it. And it's an incredible tool. And what it is, the cockloft nozzle is this. It's a pipe. It's a pipe that's 6 feet, 3 inches high, let's say. Okay? And regular pressures we use. Whatever you use for inch and three-quarter line, it's the same pressures. And I think, if I can remember, I think it puts out like, I want to say 80 gallons a minute, but it's got two heads on it. It's 60 or 80 gallons. I can't remember off the top of my head. And what it does is, you could spin it, but, you know, you could turn it, and it could, you know, you pierce the cockloft, and, it can reach, a good amount of distance, and it could put out the fire in a cockloft. And I think the, according to our operational procedures, we're supposed to stretch a line with it for protection, which I think makes all the sense in the world. And it's really starting to gain usage. And if you're really interested and you want to know anything about the cockloft nozzle, like, feel free to contact me, because, like I said, I think guys are really starting to, like, call for it, like, a lot quicker now. Like, it's actually becoming now part of our arsenal. Like, if I were to have a top floor fire, that would definitely be in my toolbox, it won't be my first line, it won't be my second line, but if we can't get it and we stretch two lines now, my third line, I'm going to call for a cockloft nozzle, especially if we have extension. And, I thought up of an idea, and I don't know why we don't do it more often, but when I first came into the fire department, it was very usual that guys would try to find the window, but then again, these were vacant buildings anyway, but... And they would use a rope to, bring up the line and bypass the interior stairs. And I don't know how that happened, but I don't see it as much anymore. I know I had the guys do it recently, but one of my thoughts is that, you know, what would be wrong with getting, let's say, a 2.5 or 3-inch, whatever, like a larger hose, attaching a Y to it, bring it up to the floor below. Now you have, like, in essence, a portable standpipe on the floor below or the half landing below in a window, and you have a top floor fire. So your first line would be off the Y, would be, you could use the, you know, you could use that cockwolf nozzle. So this would be like, let's say, the third line or the second line, right? You have two lines going. So we're going to use the rope anyway. So throw a Y on there. Use that for the standpipe, for the cockwolf nozzle, and then stretch another line as your backup line. And now you have 2-for-1. So this is something that I conceptualized, and I would love to, I'd like to try it, you know. I'd like to try it, and I think I might have the opportunity to do it, because I think that, you know, with these larger multiple dwellings, you know, the time it takes us to get the line in operation, you know, sometimes you're talking about 10 to 15 lengths of hose, depending on how far the hydrants are and where the rigs are placed. And, you know, we don't want engines really taking the front of the building, especially in a top floor fire. We like to reserve the fronts of the buildings for the aerial ladders, for roof access, and for the throw, we want to have the towel ladder, you know, just in case we need it. So, you know, you might have your second engine, you know, might not be on that close hydrant. It might be down the block 300 feet. So, you know, anything we could do to expedite stretching a hose, I think, is something that should be looked at. So, I don't know if your department even has a cockwolf nozzle, but if they were thinking about it, you know, if you have these types of buildings where you have larger cockwolves, it's something to think about. What else we have here now? All right. You know, another thing with the top floor fires, especially in what we call row houses or row frames that have common cockwolves, it's not unusual for us to have, let's say, a row of like 8 three-story attached row frames. You know, and they're type 4 buildings, or actually type 5 if you go by like the national, but we call them in New York a class 4, but they're a type 5 wood construction, all wood construction. And especially if you get a fire in a cockwolf, which some of those cockwolves are very deep with lots of lumber. And, you know, whatever little fire stopping there is, any kind of nogging or whatever, it cannot be relied on. And, you know, one of the challenges for battalion chiefs, especially when we have a good fire in a row frame that's attached, is trying to get ahead of it. Because I'll tell you right now, It's virtually impossible on a fire that has a good head of steam to get ahead of it if you don't have, like, the adequate resources. Because once you even fall back a little bit, and I know this firsthand from experience, that it's very, very hard to catch up. I mean, it's extremely hard to even get back to even, you know. So if you had, let's say, a fire in a group of 8 attached row frames. Let's say it's in the middle one. So you have 3 on one side and 4 on the other, let's say. You may have to skip a building, you know, to get ahead of it, because it's probably moving a lot quicker than you can get up there with the lines. And the other thing that has to happen, though, is that the you know, when you're checking the cockloft, when you're checking up and you want to open up the top floor ceilings, you have to be very, very careful with, you know, being too aggressive. Because if you start opening things up and you don't have a hose line, all you're doing is you're just going to feed the fire. And it's just going to even get that more steam. So it's highly, highly recommended that If you know, you have guys up there, and you know they're checking to the parameters of this fire, let's say, and we're trying to see the limits. And you send the company, let's say, into the on the, what do you say, the A B side, you know, the second building in B2. Let's say we call it exposure 2 side. And a firefighter would poke a hole up there, and he sees orange. You know, don't keep opening. You know, get the line, but you may have to just, if it's already up there and you have very limited resources, you might have to just tell the guys, hey, listen, you know, let's move to the next building and let's see if we can work our way back in. So that's always been the challenge with the roof frames, because they're such, you know, fast-moving fires, you know. So and the same can be said about taxpayers as well. You know, when you have a row of stores, it's not unusual to have 8 stores, 6 stores, you know. And again, you know, fires generally, if they start in the rear, usually the roofs are pitched where the high side is up the front, so the fire is going to travel up that way. So it's important, again, to, yeah, you might have to skip a store and get guys in there with 10 and 12 foot hooks and open up and make sure that there's hose lines available, you know, to get up into that cockloft. You know, something that you could do if you know, I'm pretty sure that most departments don't have what they call this cockloft nozzle, but what we did before the cockloft nozzle is we would get a guy with the nozzle, and he would stand up on a case or something like that, or a table, and try to open a good size, you know, hole in the ceiling, and then try to get up there and put that nozzle up into the cockloft and kind of just move it around. And I've seen that done numerous times, and that was always a good way to, you know, to get water on a fire in the cockloft, especially when you don't have access to it, you know. So just so you know, the last note I'll end on this. You know, getting back to fires and cocklofts, and you know, again, you want to get companies up into all the apartments. So let's say, just for argument's sake, you had an H type or a large tenement type building, and you had 5 or 6 apartments on a top floor. So you really need to now to get in there and check out, you know, where the fire is going, and open up the ceilings. But I do recall a number of years ago where it was on the Grand Concourse, and we were coming in it was a heavy fire in a cockloft, and we were in the other wing, and we forced the door, and there was no fire there at all, but we had two fatalities. And I'm trying to get my head around, like, I guess it was carbon monoxide, because there was no fire. It was really no smoke. But it must have been loaded with carbon monoxide, because they're elderly people, you know. And so that's something that, you know, you really need to consider, like, because you really, like, need to get into every apartment on a top floor, even if there's a firewall, or what you think is a firewall, because, you know, sometimes what appears to be a firewall is not. And what I mean is they'll run an I-beam and they'll cover it with, let's say, tar paper and roofing. And if you took your hook, if a firefighter took a halogen or a hook and made a little hole and try to jam that hook underneath it, you'll see that, you know, it's not a firewall. It passes from one wing or one side of the building to the other. So, you know, very, very strongly recommend, you know, if you're standing in front of the building and in your command, you know, get into every single apartment if you have a top floor fire. You have to check everything. You cannot assume just because there was no fire in that apartment that everything's cool. Like, you're going to have to be like, guys, you know, I know it was a one-room fire or whatever, but I want you to, if you have to force the door, but you have to get in and search that whole top floor. There's no doubt about it. And There was another instance on the Grand Concourse, actually. It happened there, and I think it happened to a friend of mine, my friend Pete. He was killed. He worked in Rescue 4. And, you know, it has to do with roof ventilation and cutting the roof. And, you know, it can't be overstated how important it is to cut that roof, to get those products of combustion to go up and to stop the horizontal spread. But what had happened at this particular fire, and I think it happened when Pete got killed in Astoria back in 1995, let's say, it appeared that the cock loft, you know, the top floor was vented because it was a visible fire coming through the hole. But what had happened was the tar had melted and sealed the cock loft, right? So picture being on a roof, and you see heavy fire, and you give a radio report. You know, roof firefighter to command, we have a vent hole on the roof, all good. And now everyone takes it at face value, like, okay, everything's good. Now the guys on the top floor go to work, and they start opening up, and they're pulling ceilings. The next thing you know, this oxygen-deprived, full of high heat and combustibles, gets this influx of fresh air and explodes. And that's what happened on the concourse, and guys got burned. A few guys got burned pretty badly. I knew one of the guys. I worked with him in Harlem. But I have a feeling the same thing may happen to Pete McLaughlin, where, you know, it's no fault of anybody's. It's just, I probably would have done the same thing. I would have gave that report, like, yeah, the roof's open. We got a nice vent hole. But one thing that you got to use caution. Even if we have a nice sized hole over the fire, I would still caution the guys to have a hose line, you know, right there, handy when they're opening things up, because who knows, you know, stranger things happen. It's just you know, it's just very volatile. You know, that little cock loft is full of heat. And, you know, one thing I do like, and if you're ever around about, I know we have them in New York. I wonder if they have them in other cities. We call them cocklow vents. And, you know, they're good and bad. I think they're good in a sense where that you would never get that situation. But the downside is that with the cocklow vents, that if we get a fire up there, it's gonna feed the fire. And, you know, it's going to have a unlimited supply of air. But that being said, I would highly doubt that you would get that explosive atmosphere with those cockblow vents, because it's already opened, you know, so you don't have that oxygen deficient area where, you know, if you introduce anything, it's going to explode. So it's just something to think about when you're doing the vertical ventilation. You know, encourage the guys to just make sure that, you know, that it's the cockblow is vented as well. And, you know, other things that could be done, you know, open the returns in the skylights, you know, just anything, bulkheads, everything has to be opened up. We want things to go up and not sideways, and that's how we get extension, right? So, that's it. We're kind of out of time. 760-454-8852. If anyone would like to chime in or talk about anything before we wrap it up. I'm getting ready to go down to Florida to do a little class with a small department down there as a favor for my sister. Some Brotherhood Ride is, they do some kind of work in Fort Myers, Florida. I don't know the name of the organization now. I'm sorry. Jeff's the captain in Naples, I think, and he's running it. So I'm going to do a little class down there. And then we have 16 firefighters coming up from Chile to the Palm Beach Fire Academy, April 16th to the 20th. And then I go home for a day, and then it's out to the big time. I'm doing Tuesday, 8:45, I think, first class, 8 o'clock in the morning, I think. I don't even know the room number. It's going to be the first new battalion chief, and we're going to really get into size up and strategy, and then I'm going to run a few scenarios and talk about some case studies, some fires that we had over the winter, and some of the things that we might have been able to do better, that I might have been able to do better. You know, it's always, the interesting about firefighters is that, you know, we do sometimes get a little too critical, and, you know, it's tough, because, you know, you have to make these life and death decisions, like, in 10 seconds, you know? It's not like you have all this time in the world to think about these things, so... you know, mistakes happen, or things that we could have done better happen. So I'm going to do my size up in strategy, and I'm going to review some of the fires that happened this winter, and some of the things that went good and some things that didn't go so good. And then I have some command sims. Jonathan Kay has that software, and I'm going to use that and put guys in the hot seat and do some size up and some strategy stuff. So anyway, if you're on FDIC and you ever listen to the show, I'm always around. I'm usually hanging around that 141, that room, the speaker's room. So if you see me, please, I encourage you to say hello. I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are. And if there's other things that you want to talk about, just let me know. And that's about it. We got a big snowstorm coming. I'm back to work tomorrow night, my first night back, and they're expecting like a dozen inches in the city, so they've already closed the schools. So that'll be it. So, all right, be safe. I hope to see you out in Indianapolis, and I'd love to meet you if you're there, and say hello. All right, take care now. Be safe.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.